Welcome back to the Evidence-Based Rheumatology Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Putman, and this is episode 106, Room for Debate. Now, we are debating the following motion. Asymptomatic patients with RA and high-risk features should be screened using pulmonary function testing and a high-resolution CT scan. Now, this is a very spicy motion, one that I'm excited to discuss. I know that a lot of rheumatologists are familiar with the recently published guidelines from the American College of Rheumatology, which focused on the treatment and screening, the management and screening of patients with interstitial lung disease, kind of writ large, those that are associated with autoimmune diseases. But today we want to focus on the rheumatoid arthritis side of it, of this, and we have two excellent debaters to discuss this motion. So the first is Joshua Salmon. He's an associate professor from Denver, Colorado, and the director of their interstitial lung disease program. You'll be arguing in favor of the motion. And Scott Mason, he's an assistant professor in the pulmonary as well from the University of Kansas City, who will be arguing in opposition. So I'm excited to have both of them on the podcast. Gentlemen, thank you for joining me.
Thank you.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
All right. So we're going to follow the typical Oxford style debate format. We're going to have 3 minutes of opening from each of our debaters. Then we're going to discuss a little back and forth, have people clarify and see if we have can kind of find some common ground or perhaps some areas of persistent difference. And then we're going to give each of our debaters an opportunity to close. So with that, I'd like to dive right in. Again, the motion is asymptomatic patients with rheumatoid arthritis and high-risk features should be screened using pulmonary function testing and a high-resolution CT. Josh, the floor is yours.
Thank you. So I'm going to make an argument for screening select patients for interstitial lung disease. I'm not going to deny there's a lot of knowledge gaps in this area, but I do think the evidence is mounting and enough to justify starting to talk about screening. Do I think we're ready to screen today or tomorrow? I don't, but I think we have enough knowledge to have this discussion and potentially come up with some screening guides. So just to take a step back, I'm sure you guys know, and so do your listeners, that screening decisions are complex, right? They're made under a great deal of scrutiny. We have plenty of history in our field. You can go back to lung cancer screening, how long it took us to get lung cancer screening guidelines, and there are still issues with that. Guidelines change over time, right? We have the age of mammograms has dropped from 50 to 40. I mean, screening guidelines are difficult and take a lot of discussion. So I appreciate that part of it. But let's talk about why we screen and let's apply this to rheumatoid arthritis ILD. So, we want to find a disease early in an asymptomatic stage before it has an impact on patients' quality of life, if we can do something about it. So screening for diseases that we can't treat doesn't make sense. So why would we do it in RA-ILD? I went back and looked at some of these screening principles. And so back in the 1960s, they came up with these principles on how to screen, and I just want to run through some of them quickly. These are the diseases you should screen about, right? It's an important health problem. I think we can all agree that interstitial lung disease and RA is quite important. Scott, you published on this and others that you screen RA patients, you'll find interstitial lung abnormalities. That definition, that's not what it's really defined as, in about 20%. And these progress over time. Some portion of them do. When it progresses, it has an impact on mortality. If you delay the diagnosis, you can worsen outcomes. So it's a disease that impacts our patients and progresses over time. You have to understand the natural history of the condition, which I think we are learning about, and I think we know. There has to be an asymptomatic phase, which there clearly is an RA. Usually by the time we see them in the pulmonary clinic, they already have compromised pulmonary function, so it's a little late. The screening should be acceptable to the population, so CT scans with low radiation. I think it's easier to make that argument that CT scans are safe. There should be a policy on whom to treat. I think that's where we're going to disagree. So does treatment work and does early treatment affect progression over time? I think we can have a debate about that. There's some data on that, which we'll talk about. And the cost of this case finding should be balanced. And I think it is. CT scans and PFTs, I think, are a good way to screen it. And I think it's cost balanced in terms of the impact ILD has on patients. And if you don't catch it early, the impact it has on the healthcare community. So I think, in conclusion, I think a screening program, not just scanning everyone, but a process discussing risk and benefits with patients in high-risk individuals makes sense and is justifiable. Sorry about my alarm.
No, that was a great opening statement. All right, and then arguing in opposition, we have Dr. Scott Mattson. Scott, take it away.
Thanks. I appreciate that. I think this is a really important topic, and I'm glad that we have some moments here to get a little bit more nuance on this. I guess I fundamentally agree with Josh that for us to impact the natural history of this condition, there probably is going to be screening involved in that process. But But my problem with this particular motion is in clinical practice now, I think there's two primary problems I have with this. The first is, as Josh mentioned, we've looked at how many patients with RA have subclinical ILD on HRCTs and PFTs in an empiric study, and it's a high number, you know, it's 20%. And if you limit that to what is sort of a quote unquote high risk group, it's much higher than that. And, you know, in screening, the reason that low dose CT scans, for instance, in lung cancer took so long to get guidelines is because it takes a long time to generate the important evidence to know whether or not the marginal benefits of the effect size of the therapies available to us now, when expanded to asymptomatic patients, whether or not that's a net harm or a net benefit. And for me, in the absence of any empiric study to define those patients who are going to progress, to define those patients whose symptoms get to the stage where they actually might benefit from the therapies that are available to them, to me, my concern is without studying it, there's the potential for applying harm to those patients who may never have developed disease. And then I think my biggest limitation is what Josh already mentioned, which is for slow-dose CT scans for lung cancer, there's a large empiric evidence for what to do about lung cancer when you identify it. And for us, we live in a essentially data-free zone where, you know, there's one randomized controlled trial in RAILD that Josh is the first author of, and it's a negative study. And so we lack any really randomized studies in this space for the actual clinical disease at the extremes of the phenotype, where we're not sure if there even is a moderate or marginal effect size for clinical disease. And as we expand that back to an asymptomatic group, my concern is we have no idea what we're doing with the clinical disease. And in an asymptomatic group, I really worry about what that means about harms and quality of life and you know, the potential downside for applications for those people.
All right, excellent opening statements. I think y'all have highlighted a lot of the problems that I see and that I think people have brought up when they have sort of argued on both sides of this equation. So for the next part of this debate, we're going to go into sort of a question and answer session where I hope to highlight some areas of agreement and then some places where you may still disagree. And I think it might be illustrative to cover some of those. So my first question, based on what y'all have said so far, and this kind of gets to the heart of the issue for me, just to summarize, you know, Josh said, you know, important health problems are we screen things when they're important health problems that we can detect early, where early intervention reduces bad outcomes. And then Scott pointed out, you know, some of these patients have subclinical disease. If we're treating these asymptomatic people, you know, is there net harm or net benefit? And so I want to focus on that right now. Is the benefit of treating asymptomatic people going to outweigh the potential harms of treating differently or changing treatments, do more aggressive treatments to people who, by definition, are asymptomatic? So Josh, to you first, do you think that the benefit outweighs the harm there?
I think it's you have to dive a little bit more deeply into that. So this idea of asymptomatic is tough in my world or the pulmonary world, right? We often find disease that patients don't know about that has a significant extent on imaging that, you know, for either they have articular disease that's limiting their ability to be active or they're just not active and not getting breathless. So I think, you know, I think early minimal disease that is asymptomatic but also doesn't have a physiologic impact on patients with normal PFTs, I think that's different, right? And I would agree. I don't think the risk-benefit ratio favors initiating therapy in those patients. I think by screening, you find patients with varying levels of disease extent. And when you get to a certain extent of disease, we know that's a risk factor for progression. And in those patients, I think you'd be following them more closely and or having that discussion with the patient about the risks and benefits of initiating therapy. So I don't think it's a one size fits all. I think you find later disease and earlier disease. And I would agree with Scott that, you know, these early asymptomatic patients with very mild disease, I wouldn't be starting those patients on therapy.
So a little bit of nuance. Scott, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, I think that Josh is very thoughtful. And I think that that kind of nuance is really needed and important. And I guess my concern is, how much of that nuance will actually be translated into actual clinical practice? Because the recognition of ILD for a patient and a physician in an RA patient should raise their concern significantly. It's such a high morbidity and high mortality sort of manifestation of RA that I think you're hard pressed to find people who may not want the patient themselves, may not, you know, how many of them would not want a change in therapy, or how many physicians themselves may not start the train of referring to pulmonology and then having therapeutic changes made. And I think what I think is true is that this is not screening a general population. This is screening a patient population who have a systemic disease for which RA ILD is a common manifestation of it. And so I am in total agreement that we should learn more about these patients, and screening can be a total, it should be an enormous pillar of where we stand from an empiric research standpoint to understand who gets worse and how to treat them. But I just come back to the idea that there are going to be a lot of patients who we identify ILD in who do not progress. You know, if on a CT scan in our study, we identify 21% that have clinical ILD, and we know that in cohort and autopsy studies, that number is closer to 10 or less percent of all RA patients. It means there's a significant number of those patients who have radiographic ILD who do not progress. And in a world where we have medications that have a marginal benefit and we haven't studied it, it behooves us, I believe, to get more empiric data on changing therapies that have been effective for patients, you know, if they're on effective DMARD regimens and we stop them and change them because of ILD, or if we're adding therapies that have modest and marginal effect sizes like antifibrotics to these patients, they do come at a quality of life and a financial cost.
Yeah, I think that's a great point. And I kind of want to tag off that because that leads to my next question from what y'all have been saying. So, you know, I agree Josh's perspective is very thoughtful and considered. And I think that that's where I start to get worried, because when the rubber meets the road and guidelines kind of enter general practice, not everyone's so thoughtful. And when people aren't so thoughtful, you wind up taking folks who have maybe asymptomatic disease and maybe Josh wouldn't have treated them. And you wind up making some treatment decisions that I think are frankly a little bit strange. And so I want to, I had a patient recently in clinic. He came in high CCP, very aggressive disease. I put him on methotrexate and he did great. And I'm glad that I didn't screen him and put him on something else because he's doing great on methotrexate. But so when you screen people and identify it, I'm worried people are going to change their therapies. And so, Scott, I'd like to put this to you. You know, if you identify someone, if so, say someone in the community identifies a patient with, you know, ILD, and they're probably going to try and adjust treatment to that. Now, how do you see that going? What would you be recommending for them? Are you worried about this concern about people getting maybe therapies that aren't biologically active, like antifibrotics? Where does this go in the real world?
Yeah. So this is a patient with clinical ILD, right? They have symptoms.
Let's say clinical ILD.
Yeah. So to me, again, this is my day-to-day life as a clinician and as a researcher, which is we have no data to guide these decisions that are really meaningful. We're extrapolating from other conditions, and we're extrapolating from studies that are not specific to RA patients, some of which have harm and some of which have benefit. But, you know, I think this sort of comes down to how you feel at this point. And RA is a systemic autoimmune condition. It appears to have clear inflammatory associations with disease activity in the presence of ILD. So my general approach is to ensure that there's adequate immune suppression that can, quote unquote, target the lung in these patients who have RA and have ILD manifestation. And if a patient comes to me with progressive lung disease, but their RA disease is well controlled, often my first step is to add immune suppression to that patient that I believe targets the lung, and in that case may leave out some of the joints if they're well controlled. That might be an agent like mycophenolate. If a patient has uncontrolled disease activity in their joints and ILD, then often choosing a systemic agent that can affect both, like rituximab, potentially tocilizumab. And often those are my first steps for these patients. And then if they progress in spite of that with sort of adequate otherwise disease control, that's when I might consider antifibrotic therapy.
All right, I like that. Very specific. Josh, would you like to pull anything apart there? Does that seem pretty reasonable, or do you have any disagreement?
Scott and I trained in a similar area. I wouldn't disagree with most of that. The only thing I would add is that I think in the pulmonary world, you know, this is not just one disease. I always have problems with RA-ILD as a blanket term, because, you know, there are disease phenotypes, right? And Scott sees this and I see this. We do have patients who come in with, you know, a typical UIP pattern on imaging, right? When you biopsy those people, you look at it under a microscope, it looks like UIP with the caveat of some lymphoid follicles and germinal centers, but it is a progressive fibrotic disease. And in the patients who have progressive fibrosis, those patients really do poorly, right? I mean, that a couple of years ago, this was looked at, and their 2-year, 3-year mortality is very high. So the only caveat is I think there are different disease phenotypes, and in those progressive fibrosis, you're right, we don't have great data, but, you know, could you make an argument that if you come in with progressive fibrosis, you could start an antifibrotic? I think an antifibrotic without immune suppression is probably not the right answer, but I do think that sometimes they take combination therapy. I mean, these patients, when they progress, it's scary. And if they're on CellCept or on AZA, I will add an antifibrotic if I see that fibrosis pattern and I see that it's progressive. That's the only difference I think I would add. And I think Scott may agree with that.
Let me push you on that then. So, I mean, yeah. I think that I agree. I mean, if I have a patient who's progressing despite adequate immunotherapy, I would also eventually reach for an antifibrotic. But is there any way that we can predict this? So are there people who aren't clearly progressing, but who you are especially worried about, where you would escalate more quickly up front or start of an antifibrotic early?
We're not good at predicting, right? I mean, you know, there are biomarkers that have been reported, but in a clinical setting, it's really hard. I mean, if you look at that negative TRAIL trial with pirfenidone, that trial enrolled, I'm not going to talk about the efficacy of drug, but that trial enrolled patients. To get into that trial, you had to have 10% fibrosis on imaging. That's it. And over the course of a year, they lost vital capacities that were the placebo group that were close to that in IPF. I mean, they had significant progression just by limiting it to patients with disease extent. So in my opinion, disease extent is really important. We're learning more and more about this, that it predicts progression over time. So those people worry me, obviously, when you have an extent of disease. When you have early ILAs, as Scott mentioned, which may be, you know, 20%, some of them progress, but I think we're not good at predicting in a clinical setting who's going to progress over time. We're just not good at it.
Scott, anything to add?
No, I think that's right. And in the absence of empiric data, my bias is generally to do less. And, you know, in that sense, you know, my approach, I think, is just a little bit more less aggressive, I think, on that early recognition. But, you know, this, I think Josh had mentioned this earlier, this, I think, fundamentally, this discussion and these guidelines are a call for more data, because we are all of us just operating in a vacuum. And I think everybody's trying to do their very best. And one of my concerns is just, like IPF, is there potential harm to the standard of care? And until we study it, it seems hard to expand the patients who should be exposed to that standard of care.
Yeah. How long, in the ILD world, how long were we using, you know, prednisone, azathioprine, and N-acetylcysteine in patients with IPF before we learned through the PANTHER trial that it was harmful? So I agree. It's, you know, we're using drugs that we don't know their efficacy and they have safety concerns. So it is very difficult. And you know, I brought up all that screening in the past. Really, to get screening guidelines, like the lung cancer screening guidelines, you really have to prove that screening improves mortality. That's right. And it took them a long time to do that. Earlier studies had that lead time bias and were sponsored by tobacco. So it really, I agree that you really, in a perfect world, you need to show that screening not only picks up disease early, right, and that your false positive rate's not too high, but you also have an impact on outcome. And I do think that we're not quite there yet. I don't know if that means I lost the argument, but I do.
Sounds like it to me.
I think I just lost.
No, I think the argument's been great.
I think it's critically important. Totally, I agree, right? Screening without knowing what to do, you know, our patients want that, but I just don't think they understand the complexities of false positives, right? That's the problem with lung cancer screening, right? How many false positives do you have? That's an issue. So yeah, I agree. We need more data.
Josh, let me hold you on that point for just a moment, because you mentioned the PANTHER trial. You said, you know, we give prednisone, N-acetylcysteine, azathioprine for a while, and then, oh no, that's actually a pretty terrible idea, it seems like, after we run this big trial. But so we ran PANTHER IPF, we got that result, and the guidelines that we just published said, you know, we can give some steroids and some azathioprine for ILD. They dropped the N-acetylcysteine, but I mean, because that trial was sort of a strategy trial, not like a single agent, we don't really know whether it was AZA or prednisone or N-acetylcysteine that drove the frankly scary findings. So what is your interpretation of PANTHER IPF? Is that an argument against AZA as I kind of see it, or how do you land there?
Well, I think there's actually some more data looking at N-acetylcysteine and some genetic variants and who it has impact on. I don't think it definitely is not clear from that. And there's some talk about drug toxicity in that trial. Maybe that was what was being masked. So I don't think it's that clear, but I think it just gives us a little pause, right? I mean, right now, because since we don't have a full understanding in RA, but when you walk in the door with RA and a UIP pattern of fibrosis, I mean, you have pause in giving that patient azathioprine, though we do it. But I don't know the answer. That's a good question. I mean, we're not putting them on pred, aza, and NAC. We know that. But I don't know the answer. I do take pause. Scott, what do you do? Do you ever put azathioprine on your patients with RA and a UIP pattern of fibrosis?
It would be extremely rare for the same reasons. IPF is fundamentally a subjective diagnosis, a wastebasket, essentially, that includes many different kinds of phenotypes with one radiographic pattern. And RA is a, again, it's a different kind of thing with different manifestations itself within the lung. And so taking all comers with even fibrotic RA, there's NSIP in there, there's UIP in there. And unfortunately, I think it's some of our own observational data that just sort of reported azathioprine within RA-ILD, which is, you know, it's a confounding by bias observational study, but it's used a lot. And that's primarily what that study, I think, shows is that it was the most common ILD specific immune suppression in RA amongst five ILD centers that we had looked at a few years ago. So I can't imagine. Yeah. And I, you know, it's not something I use in my practice, but again, it's hard for me to know if this, even in the Panther study, is this an immune suppression general effect? And the same thing should be true for RA, is immune suppression as a strategy the right option? And within that, is azathioprine the least likely useful within that?
Right. Yeah, I just want to make one quick comment. I agree with that. I do use it some, and I in these patients, and the reason I use it, I mean, the rheumatology world is going to yell at me, but it has a little more effect on the joints. But also in the patients who have inflammatory lung disease that's progressing, and you max out your, you know, CellCept, you have a max dose. In AZA, right, you have the ability to push that dose until you see the white count drop, and I think you can be more aggressive in terms of immune suppression, but it is uncommon to use. And we always just, we don't know the answer to your question, but I think it gives us pause when we use it.
I will, as a rheumatologist who's skeptical of AZA, I will admit that it does have some benefit. I don't think it's a terribly effective RA drug, but it does have some benefit in joints. I will acknowledge. I think that brings us to the end of the Q&A part of the debate. As a reminder, the motion is asymptomatic patients with rheumatoid arthritis and high-risk features should be screened using pulmonary function testing and a high-res CT. Arguing for your closing statements, about 30 to 60 seconds to round things out, is Joshua Solomon. Josh, would you like to give us your closing statements?
It's going to be tough, but I will. So my closing argument is that we all agree on many points, which is that ILD and RA is prevalent. It has an impact on outcome. It progresses. And we have some treatment data that is not optimal. Most of it's retrospective, but we have some treatment data. But also these patients, I think, when being found, you know, having discussions about treatment, but also following them to look for that progression. When we finally see these patients in clinic, the most common thing I see is moderately advanced fibrosis when it gets diagnosed. And at that point, you, at a minimum, you try to slow it down, but you've really lost a ton of lung function that you're not getting back. So I do think that when, if we can identify high risk patients, right, patients who are at risk for having ILD, and we can screen them, doesn't mean we're going to put them all on treatment, but we can get them in to see the pulmonologist. You can see the physiologic impact of that ILD. You can look for predictors of progression, follow them over time. And when you do see progression or can predict that they're going to progress, I think you can have that discussion early on to initiate therapies that, again, we don't have good data in, but that we are using, as opposed to finding them when they get breathless and spend 12 months out in the community. So I think we should be screening high-risk patients and at least getting them to a pulmonologist to follow them over time and or discuss therapy.
All right. Well considered. That is certainly the dream. Scott, would you like to finish with your closing statement?
Yeah. And again, I appreciate both you guys. I think this has been a thoughtful discussion. I guess what I would say is RA patients should be screened for ILD with HRCT and PFTs, but in a randomized controlled trial, like in a randomized setting. We should screen those patients and then we should do something about it. We should put them on to a treatment pathway, or we should just say that you continue on the standard of care. And I think that to me is the step that we are at, because all the things that Josh said, I believe to be totally true. But I do worry because we don't know any of the actual downstream consequences of treatment in this population, even in the phenotypes of clinical disease. And so in a screened population, I think it's even more important for us to learn that information. And so I am totally on board with screening, but it has to be done within, in this case, within the confines of an empiric study.
All right. Excellent. Well, thank you to both of our debaters. It's been a pleasure having you both on the podcast. And thanks to everyone else for listening. I appreciate you tuning in. And with that, we'll wrap it up. And everyone, have a great week. Thanks, gents.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks, Mike.
Thanks, Josh. Thanks, Mike.